Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. Now, later on, we'll be talking about what can be seen in the night sky for the coming month. But we'll start, as usual, with what's happening in the world of spaceflight and astronomy then, John.
Indeed, Dave. Hello. Quite a few interesting topics over the last month have caught my eye. And as so often, we always seem to talk about SpaceX, and they're at it yet again. We've had now the very first glimpse of their new rocket, which is called the Falcon Heavy. Now, you'll remember that what we've been talking about in the past is their rocket called the Falcon 9. Well, this Falcon Heavy is effectively three of those strapped together. Side by side. Now, that new rocket is at Cape Canaveral. It's on the old Apollo launch pad, 39B, I think it is. And that's going to have fueling and tie-down tests this month. So it's going to be rolled out unfueled, erected up, which has already happened, to the gantry, fuel inserted, defueled, taken down again, as part of these tests. The idea of a tie-down test is to have the rocket launched in position, but fire its motors just to test that they work under full power. But it will not be launched. The brackets will hold it in place. But it's an amazing concept. These three Falcons all strapped together will make it the most powerful rocket in the world at the moment, second only to the Saturn V of yesteryear. But it's the most powerful at the moment by a factor of more than 2-1 compared to any other launcher. And as in the past, we've talked about SpaceX with their Falcon 9 have mastered the art of landing the rockets vertically again and reusing them, refurbishing them. From this particular Falcon Heavy, two of the outside two Falcon 9s are ones that have flown to space before and have been refurbished and incorporated now into this Falcon 9, with a new one in the centre. When this launches, and the January is meant to be the launch, maiden launch date, we don't know the exact day, but things have been held up because of the government shutdown. So workers at the Cape had to stop work because of the US government shutdown. It's back in operation again now, but it will have delayed things. But two of these boosters, when they separate from the central one, will come down, fire their rockets to reverse their trajectory, come back to the Cape, and both land within seconds of each other on the concrete aprons. The central core will carry on, release the second stage to put satellites into orbit. That's what would normally happen. And then that new central booster will again return to a third apron in the middle of the other two. So that's going to be incredible to watch that. Now, I did say just a moment ago, normally it would be putting satellites into orbit. But Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, he doesn't only own SpaceX, he also owns, of course, the car company, electric car company, driverless cars, Tesla. And what he said is he's going to put his midnight cherry coloured Tesla Roadster, the super sports car, into the top of this Falcon Heavy and launch it.
He's putting a car into orbit?
Yeah. And apparently...
No driver.
Well, they're autonomous cars.
Oh, that's true.
So he said he's going to have David Bowie's Space Oddity playing whilst this happens. I'd originally thought that he was sending it to Mars, but the payload capsule containing this car will go in a very elongated heliocentric orbit that reaches out as far as Mars. But what Elon Musk says, and I must admit I do like this, he says it really tickles him, the idea of perhaps aliens in millions of years finding this car floating in space and wondering why.
So seriously, it's going to be an orbit that's going to take it past Mars and then back in again.
About to Mars, yes, as far as the Mars orbit, not actually near the red planet itself. That's what he's saying. Wow. Whether it goes ahead or not, we'll find out. But do look out for this launch, and I hope to be able to report on that next month. But more power to their elbow. They're really advancing the concept of reusability and bringing in space and bringing the costs down. Now, next thing to talk about, as we're talking about astronauts and so on, is a little bit more sad, sadly. One of the most famous NASA astronauts was John Young, and he has just passed away last week. He was a Navy test pilot and then applied for the astronaut corps and served for 42 years. He was the first man to fly in space 6 times and has got, not just that as a first, several other firsts. He was one of only 3 that went to the moon twice. He became chief astronaut in 1984. His missions included the very first manned mission of a Gemini, that's the two-man capsule, in 1965. So that was a first, Gemini 3 that was. And then he flew later on again in Gemini 10. That was in the following year. And that was the one that rendezvoused in space with a booster rocket called the Agena D. So that was to practice the rendezvous. He then flew to the moon in Apollo 10 in 69. And if you remember, David, the Apollo 10 was the dress rehearsal for Armstrong's mission, Apollo 11. So they got in the descent vehicle, the lunar module, and went down to within, I think it was about 20 or so miles of the surface of the moon, but without landing, and then rehearsed the rendezvous with the command module again and came safely home. So that was just a few months before the first actual landing. He landed himself on the moon 3 years later in Apollo 16. And of course, by that time, they had the lunar rover, and he and his fellow astronaut, I think, did about 16 miles or thereabouts around the moon on that fantastic rover. Another first of his was the very first space shuttle mission, Space Shuttle Mission 1 in 1981 on board Columbia. He was in command of that, or flew it at least, and certainly was in command of his 6th flight into space, which was on the Space Shuttle Columbia again in 1983. Now, after that, as I said, he became chief astronaut in 84 and then was asked to resign, I think is the best way of putting it, in 87. He'd made such a pain of himself representing the astronauts, because we'd had a shuttle disaster by then, and he was the chief astronaut at that time. And so he was very much looking after the well-being of astronauts and asking awkward questions of NASA that perhaps they didn't want asked. But he carried on in NASA as a consultant astronaut. So a sad loss, but a good chap to remember. The next thing to look at is the idea of cheap launches again with a commercial company. And that's a place that you wouldn't normally expect rockets to be launched from, New Zealand. But New Zealand has now been the place from which some satellites have been launched by another commercial company. This company is called Rocket Lab. It's actually founded by a New Zealander who'd moved to the US to get funding, but he's also got New Zealand government funding, I think, helping to set up the launch facilities, which is right out on the east coast, northeast coast of North Island. And what they're going for with this relatively small rocket, only about a metre and a half diameter, and it's called Electron, by the way, they're going for small satellites, nano satellites, cube satellites. So it's only had one test flight before, and it launched successfully a few of these nano satellites on its second flight. The actual rocket motors that power this, there's nine of them, and they're called Rutherford engines. Ernest Rutherford, a scientist, was again another New Zealander, hence the connection. But what's so interesting to me, well, two things, relatively simple fueling, kerosene and liquid oxygen, and that's all they use. But each of these rocket engines, the chamber, everything, is 3D printed. And it only takes 24 hours to print each of these Rutherford rocket engines. So that's the first time, I think, that that's been done. So that's the complete rocket engine, you know, barring the, you know, the fuel tanks, but all the assembly printed in 24 hours.
That is absolutely remarkable.
It is. Obviously not with plastic or ceramics, you know, with I presume metal filings as of some description for the 3D printing. I'm not an expert in that, but fascinating concept. They have 8 further launches already booked for this year. So it shows how commerce is taking off commercial companies. And they've brought the price down per launch to $4.9 million, which is very, very low in comparison to others. The previous lowest was about $7 and a bit million from SpaceX with their Falcon 1 rocket, a smaller one than their Falcon 9, but they ditched that to concentrate on the Falcon 9 and then the Falcon Heavy. But they also claim to have the capability of 50 launches per year. Now, that is mind-blowing. That really is getting it down to be, not every day, but every few days occurrence. Mind you, if they could produce the actual rocket engines that quickly, that goes some way to explaining how they manage that. Now, quite a different topic now. Instead of things going up into space, things coming down from space. So they're meteors when they're out there in space, in the solar system, and as they shine brightly in the sky, well, people call them shooting stars, but when they land, they're meteorites. And that's if they're big enough to land, of course. Mostly they just burn up in the atmosphere as small grains of dust. But bigger ones do get down. And two of these that fell in 1998 have been subjected to some further investigation by a laboratory from the American Department of Energy. And both of these meteors, even though they're they landed separately, one in Texas, one in Morocco, show great similarities, so possibly came from the same parent body, which they think might be perhaps the dwarf planet Ceres or possibly the big asteroid called Hebe. But what is so interesting about both of these meteors is that they're both found to contain salt crystals that contain organic materials, quite complex organic compounds, and amino acids. And these salt crystals themselves can only have formed within a liquid water environment or where water had been, to give you the way in which they formed. Now, organics and amino acids are the sorts of things that, under the right circumstances, scientists believe, you know, are the building blocks and basis, perhaps, for life. So there's long been a theory that perhaps life is transported around the solar system or between solar systems, you know, by bodies such as meteors. And this finding is just further evidence that this theory might perhaps be true.
Is that the one called panspermia?
That's right. Yes, indeed. Panspermia is the idea that perhaps life itself is taken. So a similar idea. But I think if I remember panspermia saying that living compounds might exist within the interior of meteors and be taken from one body to another in some kind of a frozen status idea. But yes, that was an idea put forward by Fred Hoyle and Australia Lankan scientist whose name I really can't pronounce, Chirisarim, or no, I'd best not do injustice to his name. It's a lengthy name, but he's still around and still, you know, doing lectures on this concept. Last thing for this part of the session, Dave, is about Hubble and studying a constellation that I'll be talking about a little bit later, Orion. Now, everybody will, I'm sure, have seen pictures of the Orion Nebula, a huge star-forming region, only relatively close, 1,350 light years away, but where there's a huge cloud of gas, where that gas is condensing under gravity into stars. And when stars get sufficient mass, then nuclear fusion will start to occur, and the star will the protostar will ignite and become a star. That's long been known, but what the Hubble has been looking at within this star-forming region is using its infrared capabilities to look for relatively faint and relatively cool, low-mass objects. So the smallest stars that are regular stars are called red dwarfs. They are much smaller than our sun, but have sufficient mass to start that fusion. And are exceedingly long-lived stars. And they're the most common type of star within the whole of the Milky Way. So, of course, Hubble was expecting to find lots and lots of these red dwarfs within the star-forming region we call the Orion Nebula. But it was also looking to see, could it find things that were even smaller than red dwarfs? We have another type of object called a brown dwarf. Now, this is something that's perhaps trying to be a red dwarf, but doesn't quite get enough mass for nuclear fusion to start. So it never becomes a star. So it will be hot under the gravitational concentration and compaction of the gases into more liquid, dense sort of state. So they'll be hot, but they will cool. They won't get any hotter. They'll cool and die. So it's discovered a huge concentration of these, which I suppose isn't surprising. You know, there could be pockets of the gas where there isn't quite enough gas. You know, although it'll be attracted to within itself into a compacted ball under gravity. But if it was a tenuous gas to start with, it won't quite get enough mass to form a red dwarf. But I think what has surprised them is how many of these brown dwarfs there were. Brown dwarfs have been known about for some time, but they've never seen such a huge concentration as that. But what has also been interesting is that they have also discovered planets within the nebula. And some of those planets have been in orbit around red dwarfs. Okay, we've known about that in the past. Indeed, our nearest star, Proxima Centauri, is a red dwarf with planets. But they've found brown dwarfs in orbit round red dwarfs. They've found brown dwarfs in orbit round other brown dwarfs, so binary pairs. They've also found planets in orbit round brown dwarfs. They've even found a couple of planets without a sun some kind of binary arrangement orbiting around a common centre of gravity. So these are planets that have not formed from a star's protoplanetary disk, which is the normal way. Perhaps they've accreted from the bottom up, you know, small little concentrations just gathering a little bit more mass and never quite getting enough mass to become even a brown dwarf. So They need further observations to confirm all this. They class these as candidate planets and candidate brown dwarfs, but it's just the first study, and it's absolutely fascinating because it's quite different from what people have come to expect. So another thing, instead of going from a red dwarf now, we'll go to a red giant for another first, and this is a star called Pi 1 Gruis. Gruis is the crane. It's a constellation in the southern hemisphere, so we never see it from here. But and the Pi 1 indicates it's a binary star. The other part of the binary would be Pi 2. Now, this red giant, Pi 1 Gruis, is absolutely massive. It's 530 light-years away, several thousand times as bright as the Sun, because it's 350 times the size of the Sun. Now, in the past, we've never been able to resolve the star into a disk, any stars. That's not true anymore. With some of our biggest telescopes, we can now actually see a star as a disk, especially one as big as this. And so the European Southern Observatory's VLT, or Very Large Telescope, has been studying this star and has got it to the detail where it can actually see granulations on the surface of this star. Now, we've seen granulations on the surface of our star, the Sun, but our star has about 2 million of these granulations on its surface. That's because it's got very, very high surface gravity. So our cells on the Sun, these are convection cells raising from the in the photosphere to the top and cooling and going back down again, those are relatively small, about 1,500 kilometres across. But the granulations on this big star are absolutely massive. They're about 120 million kilometres across. Now, if you put the Sun in the middle of one of those, then one of these cells would reach as far as Venus. It's they're that big. So there's only a handful of these, relatively few, a few tens of these granules on the surface of this star. But, for solar astronomers, this is fantastic news because they're able to study for the first time not one star with cellular action going on, but now two. And hopefully, of course, they'll be able to do that for other stars as the technology improves. We believe that there's relatively few, but just because of the very low surface gravity. It's such a huge star, 350 times as big as the Sun, but its mass is only 1.5 times that of the Sun. It's a star like the Sun, but older. Our Sun will end up like this in about 5 billion years, when it stopped fusing hydrogen into helium and starts fusing helium into carbon and other things. That's when it throws off its atmosphere and swells up as a huge object. But don't worry, 5 billion years, we'll not be around to see that.
No special of your show that day.
Okay, all right. Agreed. Last thing to report is closer to home. Guildford Astronomical Society helped out the Guildford Cathedral last Saturday, the 20th, who wanted to organise a stargazing event. So Guildford Astronomical Society provided telescopes, but of course, sadly, you know what it's like in the UK. Weather got in the way, so we couldn't do any observing. Now, that was announced earlier in the day to make sure people knew that. on Facebook and so on. But still, it was wonderful to see 650 people at least still turned up for the two talks that took place on astronomical subjects. One of them was about gravitational waves. The other one was about supermassive black holes at the centre of galaxies. And to look at the stand, such as Guildford Astronomical Society had a stand there with telescopes. Surrey Satellites had telescopes there. Scientific instruments there, talking about what they launch and what they build. The University Physics Department was there, and the Commission for Dark Skies was there as well to talk about the importance of avoiding as much light pollution as we reasonably can, given the demands of modern-day living. But it was really heartening to see that number of people interested in astronomy.
It just shows how popular it is, doesn't it, John?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm. Great. Well, thank you for that, John.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
At the cathedral event, we actually had a TV report, and that's from the local TV station called That Surrey TV. And that broadcasts, I understand, on Freeview Channel 7, but particularly in the Guildford area. I'm not sure how much wider. But if you go onto YouTube, you can see that report. So I suggest just go search in YouTube for That Surrey TV, Guildford Cathedral, and you'll find the report. It lasts for a couple of minutes, but it shows the display stands, several of our telescopes, and a couple of interviews, including with our society president.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
And our constellation of the month is one that I've been talking about already, Dave, in our reports. It's one of the most recognisable constellations in the sky. It's Orion, and it's riding high in the south in the evening. So I do commend our listeners to go onto the website to listen to the, or watch rather, the video of the slides telling us all about the objects that can be found within that wonderful constellation.
Thank you, John.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Well, on those days where it's not cloudy, then we'll get some wonderful stars up in the and constellations up in the night sky. Taurus, that I talked about last month as my constellation, is riding high, and very nearby is that wonderful constellation called Orion. And not too far away from that, of course, is Gemini, the twins. Coming up in the east is Leo with its principal star of Regulus. But constellations that we've talked about in the past, like Perseus, Cassiopeia, Pegasus and Andromeda, they're all still there from the zenith down to the western horizon. Planets, though, not too many of those, so I'll cover those in a moment. Let's look at when we can see the moon. So we're still in January at the moment, so just to mention that on the 31st, we have the second full moon of the month. The first was on the 1st of January, the second will be on the 31st. And as before, Dave, can we remember what we call the second full moon in a month is
a blue moon?
That's right, absolutely. Interestingly, there will also be a total eclipse of the moon that day, but not seen from our part of the world, unfortunately. Other people will be getting a total lunar eclipse. For February, however, best time for looking at the moon really is on the 22nd. That's when it's at first quarter. So that's when the craters are best seen, the mountains and craters, because of the long shadows they cast. So a few days either side of the 22nd is best. if you really want dark skies without any moon, then its new moon is on the 15th. Let's move on to the promised planets. Well, Mercury has become an evening object, but is very difficult to find, very low in the west, and only half an hour after sunset, and then it will sink very, very rapidly. Venus at last is becoming an evening object, quite brilliant at magnitude minus 3.8, but very low in the west, and only from the middle of the month. Low in the west, just 30 minutes after sunset, but it will be better as the next few months come along. Mars is another morning object, visible from about 5 a.m. Jupiter, another morning object, easily visible in the southeast, towards the south, again, obviously, before sunrise. Saturn, in theory, a morning object, but difficult at the start of February, gets better as the month progresses, and you need to look low in the southeastern sky for that one. Uranus is there as an evening object, but of course that's one that's not visible to the naked eye. If you know where to look, binoculars will find it, but it's your telescope that reveals it much better, because it's fairly dim at magnitude 5.9. Neptune, not visible at all this particular month. There are a few events of interest, however, this month. So the 6 o'clock in the morning on the 11th, the waning crescent moon is just quite close to Saturn, just 4 degrees away from Saturn. So that might make an interesting photograph if you can find the pair. On the 12th, another pairing that is of interest: Mars and the star called Antares are just 5 degrees apart. Now, the name Antares is interesting. If you think about the two parts of the name, Ares was the Greek name for Mars, and ant means rival, anti. So it's the rival of Mars. That's because it was a similar colour. So have a look yourselves at 12th of February, in the morning, so that will be 5 degrees apart. You should be able to find Mars and Antares close together and see what you think of the colour differences. The moon won't be that far away as well, so that's a good guide as to whereabouts in the sky. On the 22nd, that lunar X that I've mentioned in the past is visible again from about 4 p.m. Now, I know it's light at 4 p.m, but if you can find the moon and turn your telescope onto it, you would see the lunar X. But the lunar X is a feature that only lasts for a few hours because of the sun angle that causes it. So it would be visible, up till about 8 o'clock in the evening. Aldebaran, which is the prime star of Taurus, is occulted by the moon on the 23rd at 4:33. So find the moon and look at the dark edge of the moon, and you should see Aldebaran nearby. Even in daylight, if you're looking at it with a good telescope or pair of binoculars exactly at the right place, you will see some of the bright stars if you're in the right place. So just next to the moon at 4:33 is when it will be occulted, in other words, eclipsed. It'll pass behind the moon, or rather the moon will pass in front of it, and so the star pops out from the bright side of the moon at 5:42. Venus and Mercury are very close together, 2.5 degrees apart, just after sunset on the 28th. Talks at local astronomical societies. We've got Croydon Astronomical Society has two meetings this month, on the 9th and the 23rd, but as yet they've not posted the subjects of their talks on their website. But they meet at Royal Russell School in Croydon. Yule Astronomical Society, have a chap I know very well, Graham Bryant from Hampshire Astronomical Group. He's doing a talk there at 8 o'clock on Friday the 9th about moon hoaxes. Quite what he'll cover, I don't know, but I'm sure that will be an interesting talk. Bit of television for you. I forgot Guildford Astronomical Society. Our talk on the...
They'll suck you, John.
I know. Our talk is on the 1st of February, and that is about a dark future. And that is by Bob Mizzen, who is the chairman of the Commission for Dark Skies, part of the British Astronomical Association. And they're looking very much, or fighting the good fight, about light pollution. So he's talking about what can be done to improve the quality of the night sky, which isn't, of course, just of interest to astronomers, but to all of us as a quality of life issue, as long as it's balanced with security, safety concerns as well, of course, but also for wildlife. So he'll be talking about those issues. Now, back to television. On Sunday the 31st of January at 9 p.m, the BBC is showing a documentary called Wonders of the Moon, and it uses imagery to reveal the life cycle of the moon, looking at eclipses, showing how the moon affects life on Earth, such as the tides, etc., and looking at what happens, within that life of the moon of 1 month. And it also talks about why we have supermoons and so on, about the orbital nature of the moon. The normal television event, of course, for every month is The Sky at Night. And its title is one that rings a bell, It Came from Outer Space, which is actually another a book title. It Came from Outer Space Wearing a Dark Blue RAF Blazer. It's a book all about Patrick Moore, who, of course, served in the RAF during the Second World War. This thing, Coming from Outer Space, is about that interstellar asteroid that I've talked about last month, Oumuamua. And it discusses what we know about this asteroid and how what we are learning changes our view of the universe. So that's on Sunday at 10 o'clock, BBC 4, the 11th of February. Repeated on Thursday the 15th, again on BBC 4, at 7:30. And that is it, Dave. My look at what's up in the night sky for what's left of January and February.
Thank you very much, John, for that fascinating preview. Now, this show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will include extra items where we ran out of time for this broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday the 23rd of February.
Excellent. Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.